You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
Hello and welcome to the 602 Club, Trek FM's local watering hole. I'm so excited to be here this week because we have a special guest from, well, I don't, what Earth are you from?
That's a good question. I'd like to say I'm from the prime Earth, but these days it's thinking more and more like I might be a Terran. I'm not certain, but sorry, I just crossed the beams here.
I guess the Zeta beams, one might say.
The cross streams. Yeah, the most important thing, right, is that if we have faith, it seems like we can travel to different Earths. So maybe we can try to find the right one together.
There you go. Let's make that happen. Well, I'm excited to have Nick Anastasio back, as this week we're going to be discussing the third season of Man in the High Castle. We've already talked through seasons 1 and 2. And really, I mean, this season is just jam-packed with things, so we have so much to talk about. Before we do that, I want to just say a quick thank you to everybody for listening, and of course, you know, for finding us wherever you get your podcasts. You can, anywhere you get your podcast, type in the 602 Club. Make sure you subscribe so you get the episode as soon as we drop it. And then make sure, too, if you're over on Apple Podcasts or iTunes, give us a star rating review, help people find the show that way. That's a huge help to us. Of course, you can find us on Twitter at TrekFM and Facebook at Facebook.com/TrekFM. We've got the listeners only discussion group where you can connect with all of the different listeners from Trek FM all around the world. That's on Facebook. Type Babel into the search field there, or on the website at trek.fm, you can hit discussion on any of the menu bars, and that would let you into that group. So you can discuss, like I said, just every single thing that we're talking about here on Trek FM, because there's so much that we are talking about. And then last but not least, maybe you would like to send an email to us. Christy and I love getting emails. So go over to trek.fm/contact, choose a show, choose the 602 Club, and that will send an email to us, and Christy and I will be able to respond to you that way. So, Nick, coming into, this isn't even on the outline, but I was just thinking about this, you know, coming into this in season 3, after where we left off in season 2, you know, we end on that shot where we see that Trudy is still alive somehow, and I'm sure you probably thought this too, that's probably not our Trudy. That's got to be an alternate Trudy. But really, leaving it on that, plus that whole conversation with Abe about, you know, why he, you know, picked Juliana and how special she is. Where were you kind of coming into the season? Were you excited about season 3? Were you, and what did you kind of maybe hope for the season?
I was very excited. Obviously, like you said, it's some of the cliffhanger-y kind of things that we were left off at the end of season 2, I had ideas for where they were going to go. But at this point, I still felt, even if I kind of knew where it was going, that it was, they were great sort of things to leave us on. More than anything, I was really excited about the character of Juliana. And I think we talked about that when we went over the first couple of seasons, is I really felt like the showrunners, the producers and writers did a great job with having her emerge as a new kind of hero, which serves the light. I'm using cross references from all over the place today, but in a way that I felt was both classic and new, because they were really saying, you know, the moral high ground, the light, is not about an idea on paper of good or bad. It's about what's inside of you. And if you look inside anyone is able to tell at any given moment what is the right thing to do. There's not a book of law, you know. There's the spirit of the law, and in a way, I feel like that was the message that I took away from season two, was look inside for the spirit of what is good, and you will know that more than any word from the outside, from any political, social, cultural, religious agenda. It's inside of you. And I thought that was a great, it felt very fresh. I was really excited to see what they were going to do with that. And at the same time as it, you know, I felt like her character did follow a lot of the beats of the hero's journey. It was a fresh enough, new enough twist on it that I really wanted to see where they were going to go with Juliana in season three.
Yeah, I thought that the way in which you end that season, where you kind of, and in some ways, you know, she gets that reward of, you know, because we leave on the cliffhanger of her sister being there, and you know, her being chosen because of the way in which her choices continually do choose the side of the right and light and goodness, and that those impact the people around her. That you know, we talk, you know, there's always the idea of the sphere of influence that you have, and that Juliana's, no matter what, you know, or universe, whatever film that Hawthorne saw, is that no matter what Juliana, she had this ability to influence those around her for the better by the choices that she made. And I just thought that was something that was really fascinating, because, I mean, it really kind of drives home the point that, you know, it's not about where we're from or who we are or what, you know, political ideology we had growing up or where we grew up or any of those things. It becomes about the choices we make, and the choices we make then are very much who we are going to be, and that those should decide who we're going to be, not some job or, you know, what culture says about us or anything like that. And, you know, that in many ways there was a sense of that, you know, obviously, you know, the main world that we see in the films that they're kind of comparing us to is our world today, you know, and the fact where, you know, they see the world where the Allies won the war. And so that there is this sense that different choices were made that allowed those things to happen. And again, it becomes about, like, what do we choose? Do we choose what is good, or do we choose what is, like, expedient? Or, you know, it's kind of like Star Wars. It's like the dark and dark side and the light side. Do we choose what is selfless, or do we choose what is selfish? And, you know, what we see, I think, in their world is a world that chooses more of what is selfish. People trying to guard that selfishness by what they create. And it just created a really interesting milieu to be in. And I think that first and second season really captured me. So coming into season three, I was pretty excited to see where they would go with all of that, because you have a big canvas now.
Yeah. And and your comparison to Star Wars is very interesting, because, I don't think that they're exclusive. I agree with you. What I thought was interesting, and again, it's not so much that one is contradicting the other. It's more kind of, I think, it's just a different approach. George, you know, has often talked about the fact that, you know, the idea of gray in his own belief is not as, like, he doesn't really believe in that. And that it's an excuse that people who do bad things often use, and that, you know, there is good and there is bad, and that it's actually pretty easy to tell the difference apart, and you can choose. Even though he has explored in his own ways in the prequel trilogy the fact that you know there's heroes and villains on both sides, but you know, the archetypes that he chooses are very much about, like, okay, evil is pure evil and good is good, and there are, you know, the whole Skywalker family is an exploration and kind of like walking the line, But at the end of the day, there's still a decision, you know, and you can't just walk the line forever, or that will actually, or the choice will be made for you. And I don't think that the world of Man in the High Castle says that there is gray, but I think that what I thought was very interesting is that it actually says, again, there's not, like, if you look at the different realities, like you were comparing sort of our world to the one that most of the story is set in the series, the easy thing to do, which most of these parallel world stories have done, is to say, well, there's, like Star Trek, for example, you know, to go back to my original comparison, there's the mirror universe and there's our universe. And generally speaking, yeah, there are bad guys and better people in both. But generally speaking, one is kind of a more negative version and the other one is the more positive version. One is kind of the one we embrace. The other one is the one we don't want. And what I like about what the Man in High Castle was doing, especially in season two, is it was saying, you know, all these things that exist are neither, there's not like a right way and a wrong way. It's not going to be, you know, and it kind of plays upon our assumptions of that. When Tagomi first crosses into our world, initially he's overcome with the idea, well, that this is a world where everything is sort of like, you know, the Prime Universe version of this story, right? And versus his being kind of the negative universe. But then he realizes, well, they have their own problems, their own failures, their own moral quandaries. And so, and I think that really kind of elevates him as a character, because then he goes to the next step in enlightenment, which is to really understand that there is never going to be such an easy thing as to say, okay, light, dark. It's inside of you, and the world is always complex, and it's really on an individual level that the responsibility begins, and that the consequences incur later. And he sees that, you know, in every reality, then there's an opportunity to do the right thing and to help create a better world. Maybe not a perfect one, maybe never a perfect one, but a better one. And I that's one thing that I was, again, really, really excited to see develop in season three, and to see what they were going to do with that. In a way, I liked what they did, but in a way, and I don't want to say I didn't like, I did feel like the most sophisticated season in terms of pushing these ideas forward was the second one. And I feel like the third one was great, and we can start talking specifically about season three, but I felt like it kind of went back towards a somewhat more straightforward, linear kind of good, bad, and sort of it didn't push some of those concepts I just talked about as far as I would have liked, except in one area that we'll touch upon, which has to do with Frank and the whole year null also with Himmler. And that I thought was really, really, really superb.
Yeah, one of the things that I thought was really interesting about season three was this kind of idea, you know, we've set up, and we've, especially in season two, we saw the Reich specifically, and the strain of people who live in this place that are having trouble living by the rules that they say they believe in, and actually finding those rules to be somewhat unlivable. So we have different versions of that, you know. When you see Nicole with her friend, you know, they have feelings that the Reich would call, you know, deviant, and you know, and yet, and they know that according to Reich propaganda and theology, it's wrong, right? Like ideology of the Reich says no, that is completely wrong. You should not do that. You know, we see that with you know, Smith and his wife, who are struggling with the reality of what their son did, because he believed, you know, the Reich ideology, and therefore he willingly walked like a sheep to the slaughter because he was not worthy to live in the Reich. And yet they both struggle with this. And then, too, I think on top of that, you know, we hear these stories about the fact that there are high-ranking Reich officials who, they have issues that the Reich would deem inappropriate or wrong, or and yet they are given a pass. And so, and in fact, I think, you know, that even brings to mind the fact, you know, Hitler wasn't pure in his own, you know, with his own rules of what racial purity would look like. Hitler was not. And so I just thought it was really interesting that we're living in this society which says that it believes something, and yet so we see so many people actually struggling to live within the confines of what they believe to be quote unquote right or true. I thought that was really fascinating because I think it shows the one of the main ways in which I think they're building the case towards the Reich possibly having more cracks than we realized. And each of these characters kind of gives a piece of one of those cracks.
Yeah, I think you're totally right. And the side of the story that explored, you know, we always go back and forth between the Pacific States and the Reich, and now we also go into the Demilitarized Zone quite a bit in season 3. And the part of the series of the season that dealt with the Reich and life under the Reich and the characters within that microcosm, that subworld, were the ones that I thought interested me the most in season 3, and where I felt like the ideas that I've talked about, which are the ones that really interested me in season 2, were pushed forward, which is kind of, it was interesting because in season 2, I felt like this was really channeled and kind of like all sort of expressed almost single-handedly through Juliana. And as you said, she was sort of disseminating that through the other characters, but she was kind of the main voice for those themes. And I felt like it was almost the opposite way this season, where it was kind of, you could kind of see it piecemeal in these secondary characters. And I didn't feel like really as strongly through her, but I really loved in the Reich. I felt like you got that exploration of these two things, which is that, well, you, first of all, I thought there was a really cool message, which is that a lot of these regimes that impose a certain type of life, a certain type of rule, and sometimes will even kind of brag about their own success by saying, you know, the whole, like, you know, the trains run on time. At the end of the day, even when they're at the height of what they perceive to be their glory, their success, you can always look to them as a failure for the exact reason you described, which is that really the only way that they maintain themselves is through force. And pretty much any time you are able to look at the microscopic level, at the individual level, you see that there is really, there's the overt sign that there is no faith at the individual level in that regime, in the ideals that it pretends to be embracing, and that it pretends that its whole population embraces. That's a fake, you know, propaganda idea that it advertises, but at the individual level, whether, again, whatever it is, whether it's fascism, communism, all of them, all any dictatorial sort of tyranny, will always, you can see that, like, it only survives as long as it's able to impose itself. But people at the individual level very quickly just kind of move on and will do what they have to do on the surface to get by, but will kind of live their own life and have their own, you know, be their own selves, whether that falls in line with the regime's idea or not. And it does show that like at every level, not just, you know, even within the ranks of the party, you kind of have people just blatantly being the exact opposite of the party ideals because this is just who they are. And so there's the surface, and then there's the reality, which usually is what also ends up undermining, because it's sort of like, you have the surface that can maintain itself through force, but then as people kind of are themselves, that sort of lays down the grounds for what will show the system for the failure that it is, which, whether it takes a year or 10 years or 100 years, usually always leads these types of regimes to fall. And then I think that you have within that also the dichotomy I was describing of people having kind of the rule of law imposed by a system, but then at the individual level, making the decision case by case, moment by moment, day by day, well, what is the right thing to do? And sometimes it's not with the best motives. Sometimes it's in a self-serving kind of way. What is the right thing for me to do? And sometimes it's just what is the right thing, period. But you see that there's that separation between what the blanket rule of law is and what people have to make, you know, on a personal level as they go on with their life. And I thought that, again, those would be...
No, I thought it was really interesting because, you know, too, especially with Nicole, I thought she was a really interesting case study because for her, you know, she is somebody who's, and in some ways, to kind of compare with Star Wars a little bit, again, I think she's Anakin-like in the sense that she's been told she's special. She's the future of the Reich. She's a Lebensborn, which means she has a different status. And I think that she then feels as though, like she can then do what she wants, like that she will be protected because she is kind of above the rule of law, which, again, when you're talking about these ideas of these different, you know, fascist and communist type regimes, that's usually what you see is you see the people that are in this special category that are above everybody else that get this special kind of treatment. And everybody knows that there's some, you know, things are going on that shouldn't be going on, at least according to the party propaganda and ideology. And yet they still happen and they get away with it. And she believes herself to be in that place. And then, of course, you know, she realizes she's not, you know, which I think is something that is really fascinating to see because there's always somebody that's higher than you. For the most part, that can make your life miserable in these type of regimes. And that's exactly what happens to her. And it's also exactly the same thing, you know, that Smith is dealing with as well. As high as he gets, he's never out from under the rule of law. You know, he's never out from under that thumb of somebody higher than him, like Himmler at this point, being the Fuhrer. And as much as he would like to be able to protect his family, he can't just brazenly forget the rules and regulations or pretend as though he's above them. And because otherwise, as we see, you're going to be re-educated. You're going to be brainwashed to mindlessly accept what the group think of the party is, which, you know, we see sadly in Joe, and there's nothing of him left. You know, in this season, there's nothing of the old Joe left. He's completely gone because of what they did to him. And I fear kind of that that's exactly what's also going to happen to Nicole. And I think that's also what we're supposed to fear could actually happen to Smith if he's not careful. And so you're just left in this place where you feel the hypocrisy of it, right? And there's no room for hypocrisy in this type of system because there's no grace in this system whatsoever. You know, this is a system completely devoid of forgiveness and grace. And so I think that's the other thing that really makes the Reich just so utterly kind of disgusting is that, you know, there's no... I think we all balk and like get frustrated with any system that doesn't allow people to make mistakes. And this is a system that definitely doesn't allow that. Don't let me fool you in thinking that I'm thinking the Reich is great all except for that. No, I mean, that's on top of all of the other horrible, disgusting, awful things that they do. That just happens to be kind of like the last straw, I think, is that, you know, you see there really isn't any room for moving against the party. Unless you happen to be Himmler or, you know, one of his like other two top or three people, you know, otherwise, you know, you don't really get a choice. And it is a really interesting place to be and to see because it's not the kind of system. It is the kind of system that we definitely fear, you know, happening. And the one where, you know, we don't want to fall back into anything like that again.
Yeah. And I mean, I think that, again, we're one of the strongest sort of points or best made points of this season lie, I think, is the expression of that message that rigidity is falsehood, and that rigidity and falsehood are never self-sustainable. And
yes,
any kind of ideology, whatever it is, again, political, religious, cultural, it doesn't matter. When it is rigid to that extreme, and again, that's also, you know, extreme and rigidity kind of go together, and that's what breeds this falsehood, will never be self-sustainable because it doesn't allow for this malleable mix of the spectrum of not everyone is going to be the same, not everyone is going to be able to embrace 100% of a value. There has to be discourse. There has to be, you know, the room for disagreement, so that we can reach agreement. And you know, the way that this is expressed in the season, that is very well done, I thought, because it just shows the hypocrisy of the fallacy of this idea that you can kind of have an absolute rule, an absolute idea that leaves no room for deviance. And when we know how different people are, we know that it's impossible. And so at the same time, at the height of a moment where an ideology thinks it is in propagating this kind of concept, you already see how it is completely riddled with everything that's going to eventually lead to it toppling itself simply based on the fact. That's the thing is, you know, these ideologies always refuse to acknowledge the very simple fact that people are very different. And so you will never be able to kind of get everyone to be so uniform that you can just maintain by itself an ideology that is so monocultural. Even if you succeed in kind of some of those insane genocidal ideas or eugenics so that you can cull and create a population that really conforms to a certain model, it's only a matter of time. It's only a matter of months or a few years until circumstances create people within that group that no longer fit within that model. And then there again, you start having the dichotomy of, well, does the model shift to accommodate that, in which then it's no longer absolute, or it doesn't. And over time, for a time, these people may have to appear to conform, but over time, as the divergence gets worse and worse, they won't, and then the system will break. And I think Smith was definitely the most interesting character for me to follow in season three, because I feel like you're right, like you can see some of the same potential risks and some of the same trajectories for him, but I think for him it's even more complex because you have all these things happening, you know, obviously just in and of itself, he's aware of what is right and wrong within the position he has and what he does. He's not a psychopath. You know, he I think enjoys to a degree his power, his authority. But you can tell that he's aware of right and wrong. And so I think there's a conflict within himself. I think that there's a conflict within him and his family that grows, which I thought was very interesting, because within the nucleus of his family, you see the dynamic I was talking about, how an ideology like that is not self-sustainable, because as the rules of the regime are becoming more and more intrusive to his family life, it starts to break apart his family. His family being a model of what that society is, you see how, like, in the long run, you cannot live like that indefinitely. And then, you know, there's I think a third source of conflict, which is really interesting, which they seem to be exploring more and more, and I really like that, is, I mean, it's also within himself, but it's kind of a past and present and future of him remembering who he was before the war was lost and what he stood for and what he fought for versus what he's become. And the fact that he became what he fought for, before the war, or what he fought against, I should say. And those are really, really interesting ideas, I think.
As you're talking, I was just kind of thinking, you know, this is something that we kind of see in the season here, was this kind of idea of the idea of quote unquote perfection, as is, you know, given to us by the party, or by, you know, Reich ideology, and the idea of goodness. And one of the things that I really appreciate about this season is that I think it does a great job of showing the utter foolishness of human ideas of perfection, and how flawed we are when we try to think of what is perfect. And I think, you know, it because we ourselves are not perfect, so therefore, how would we even know, you know, what perfect is? And so, the best that we can truly do then is I think what is goodness, and that's what we see the difference in, like with Juliana versus, you know, Reich ideology specifically. She continually chooses what is good, and you know, the ideas of what is good are, I would say, in, I mean, philosophically, they're pretty utilitarian, and it's what is good for the most amount of people, and so in this world. But still, it's better than it's so much better than choosing that some, you know, imperfect human decides what is perfect for the rest of the human race. Like, it just doesn't make any sense. Unless you're divine, you can't make that decision. And therefore, the best we can do is to follow, like what you were saying earlier, we have this innate sense in all of us of what's good. I mean, that's why when we look at the news or we look at the world, we can tell something's wrong. There is an innate sense in all of us of what is right and what is wrong, and it comes from something beyond even us. We just don't understand it, right? So, and I think that's the thing we kind of get in this season is watching the characters kind of struggle through that. And I really liked you pulling out John Smith there, because I think one of the things that this season does, on top of them living with the rules, is asking the question of how to survive, and how we survive and how we live with how we've chosen to survive is very important. And specifically with John Smith, I think we see that his choices on how he's chosen to survive are coming back to haunt him and are slowly destroying everything he's tried to protect. And because he's chosen the wrong path to try and protect things. And it's that danger that he's put himself in, and what he's done is just, I think, it's fascinating to watch, because like you said, he knows what's right, he knows what's wrong, and he knows he shouldn't have been doing these things, but he thought it was the best way to protect his family. But in the end, it's the thing that's actually really working to destroy his family. It's already killed his son. There's the possibility of losing his daughters, and he's now got a broken marriage because of it as well. And so it's like everything that he wanted to protect is slowly falling apart.
Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more, 100%. And I think, in a way, I'm not sure how intentional that was or planned, but in a beautiful way, I think he, this season, functions almost as a central character for me, like Juliana did in season two. And he is almost an exact counterpoint, but to the same ultimate result, or kind of the same point in the end is made, that she was in season two. She showed us that, like you were saying, that innate sense of what's good and wrong is what prevails and what really matters. And she went by that in season two, and it pays off in the sense that you can see her kind of avoiding all these landmines, you know, and threats, literal and figurative, through the season, because she kind of follows that innate instinct and says, I'm not going to go by something outside. I'm not going to go by, you know, what someone tells me is right or wrong, whatever side of the fence they come from. I'm just going to go with what I know my heart tells me, because that is stronger and purer than anything. Everything else is man-made. This is the only thing that's bigger than something made by man. And I think that Smith is the exact opposite in this season. You can see Smith as the product of what happens when someone tries to, for reasons X, Y, Z, lead their life relying on what is told to them is right or wrong. Whether it is, again, a political party, whether it is, you know, any kind of structured hierarchy, and absolves themselves of responsibility because they can fall back on that good old line. Well, those were the orders I was given. This is what I was told was right. And again, you see the difference between her and him is that even though she makes her choices in the face of logic at times in season two, it does carry her through and elevate her. Whereas in his case, it's the exact opposite. We catch him in season three at sort of this breaking point in his life where, like I was saying, that sort of system is not self-sustainable, and sooner or later it will catch up to you, and it catches up to him where he's hung on to as long as possible that excuse of, well, the hierarchy that I live in dictates this, tells me what to do and what not to do. But it's breaking him internally. Everything is falling apart. And as it does, because he is an intelligent character, which is what makes it interesting, he doesn't just fall apart, because he you know, you can tell that he's questioning and realizing that, well, where the decision really needed and needs to happen is where I know what's right and wrong. And that is the voice that I've chosen to ignore all these years. And I've given myself a pass saying, well, this is what I have to do or what I'm told to do. But now it's catching up to me. And then he, as the consequences get worse for him, he's having to decide how he's going to deal with that, which I think that is probably the cliffhanger, or sort of like the thing that leads to what's going to come next, which I was left with the most excited about or the most interested in to see for season four, is what is Smith going to do based on this growing conflict of the internal voice that, you know, screams louder and louder in him, this is wrong. And the more you go forward in that direction, the more you're going to make things fall apart for yourself. And Smith, as almost, you know, the Führer, who now finds himself having to actually go further and further in that wrong direction and enforce a system which he knows is not self-sustainable in the long run. And that I thought was interesting. I think in the character of Juliana, I was a little disappointed because I felt like she kind of took a step backward. And that touches upon another issue I have with season three, is I felt like there's too many characters in the season overall. And in her case, you know, they had her, it's like I think they wanted everything. They wanted her to kind of resolve her relationship with Frank. They wanted her to resolve her relationship with Joe. They wanted her to have this new love interest with Wyatt. And in doing that, I felt like they kind of unintentionally, I'm sure, had her come across a little selfish at times, because as they were trying to introduce these tangents or resolve them, they kind of had her react, you know, and every time one of these men comes back into her life or comes into her life, she sort of like spur of the moment says something to the effect of, oh, I want to be with you. No, I want to be with you. No, I'm going to be with you. And then she leapfrogs back and forth between the different possible paths. But unlike the way she was in season two, it didn't come across to me. It came across as she was just kind of almost like a kid, not really thinking about the right thing to do or what she was meant to do, but just kind of like going with the pure moment of this is what I want to do because this person is in front of me, and now I'm reminded of how cool or how beautiful they are, the relationship we had. And so she's sort of like, it's almost like the writers couldn't make up their mind as to what Juliana was supposed to do. And as they were writing each episode, they kept changing their mind oh, you know, maybe we can have her be with Joe again. No, maybe we can have her be with Frank, maybe with Wyatt, maybe. And that I thought was a little confusing and not as strong as her character had been the previous season.
It was interesting because I can see what you're saying. I didn't necessarily interpret it quite the same way because I saw her relationship with Joe being more about her kind of using Joe. I didn't see it so much as about her trying to rekindle a relationship so much as really to test out to see where he was, if he was still trustworthy, if he was still somebody that she could trust. And then in the end, you know, she realizes, I think, pretty quickly that he's not, and therefore she just kind of uses him. And because I mean, that moment where they, you know, they sleep together and then it leads to his death when she kills him, which is such a shock. I mean, it's still a shocking scene. You kind of know it's coming, but it still kind of blows your mind that they go there. But I just get this feeling like, you know, she already kind of, I feel like, instinctively understood that he probably wasn't right. And she could already sense that he wasn't the same person, because she even says that to Dagomi, you know, the Joe that I knew is gone, you know, he no longer exists. So I didn't quite feel that there. Now, I did kind of feel that, though, like you mentioned with Frank, in that moment where she reconnects with him and she wants him to come with her and everything. And you know, I felt like that just felt a little bit forced, you know, I guess in that position, you'd probably want to try and resolve whatever issues you had, because you never know what day you're going to die in this universe. And so, but I didn't feel like that one worked as well. And then, you know, it was interesting because with Wyatt and her, all of this too is interesting because I feel like this is also how Juliana is trying to survive, right? And she is somebody who's kind of learned that you can't completely ever truly trust anyone, maybe except yourself. And you have to really test to see if people can be trustworthy. And I appreciated that, you know, with Wyatt, it's more of a flirtation that they have instead of a full-blown romance. But yeah, it's just, I was a little disappointed that she kind of just hopped from man to man to man. And not that there's anything wrong with, you know, I'm not calling her any names or anything. I'm just saying, I just felt like it took a little bit. It felt like sometimes it took a little bit of agency away from her in some ways. But at the same time, there were, especially with Joe, I felt like there was the most agency because I felt like she was using him.
Yeah, it's a good point. You make a really good point. I hadn't thought about it quite like that. It sort of helps me see it in a different way. At the same time, in a way, it also kind of like, I think it helps me identify also what bugged me specifically with Joe. And it's not at all, I mean, not like I'm not a prude or anything. And like you, it's not that I want to, you know, that there's anything wrong in and of itself with that. But I think that what kind of surprised me, and not in a positive way, was the fact, like, I think I was more surprised by the fact that she slept with him than the fact that she kills him. I felt like where she was at when they meet again and what she sees in him, I felt like her character was more aware and morally kind of, not that there's, so not, I'm not saying that there's anything wrong morally with her sleeping with him, but like in terms of like the way she would look at him, I had a hard time, I think, believing that from where she's at in the story, she could see him in a way that would lead her to still feel enough attraction and affection to want to be physically intimate with him. I felt like she would not necessarily just like be revulsed or anything, but like you were saying, like at that point, she has lived in this world long enough and now is aware enough that she saw the signs right away that he was not the Joe that she had met and loved, and that, you know, she would, when she slept with him, I was like, I really remember thinking, what are you doing? There's no, you know, I don't understand why, you know, why you're going to bed with this guy. Like, you clearly can see that he's not the guy. Something's happened to him, and she doesn't know the details yet, but something's happened to him. And it felt like she was just kind of like, you know, just going with it because it was kind of like, oh, well, you know, he's this guy who I used to be in love with. And it felt to me like it undermined her character a little bit in a way that was again played up. They don't sleep together, but it was kind of the same aspect of her that I thought came out when she sort of has this impulse to tell Frank, maybe we can run away together. It's almost, even though they don't sleep together, but it's kind of the same thing. It's this sort of like this very childlike in the moment, you know, I want to believe that this doesn't have to be the way that I already know it is. And I felt like that kind of weakened her character because she came across as so much smarter and stronger than that in season two, that it felt like, you know, they were writing her a little too impulsive.
That's where with Joe, by the time she gets kind of sexual with him, I feel like she's using a ploy on him at that point. So I didn't see it quite as much as her being caught up in anything or not. I felt like she saw him for who he was at that point, but the best way to go about it was pretending like she was still in love with him and that would keep him along this line so that he keep trusting her so that she could get what she needed out of him, which is at that point, I feel like too, she's also feeling like he's probably a spy, basically. He's probably doing something wrong. With Frank, though, again, I totally do agree with you. There's that moment where she's like, well, we could run away together. And then I did get the thought that they actually slept together because she's like, well, let's just pretend for the night that we're not, that none of that is true. And it kind of wraps up their relationship and it gives closure to everything, but it does feel, it wasn't so much there's anything wrong with it. It just felt really cliched and it did feel, but at the same time, I also was trying to put myself in her position, which was, you know, when you live in such an awful world, maybe you try to take a little bit of pleasure and hope and joy in actually being alive wherever you can get it. And to just have a moment with Frank, you know, maybe that's what they're going for in that scene, which is to say, yeah, we might not be meant to be together, but we do mean something to each other. And let's enjoy this moment while we have it, which it is fine. I just don't know if it comes off quite as well as they want it to. But, I think what's real so interesting is this. When I'm thinking about this whole idea about how to survive, one of the things that I really noticed was that for John Smith, he exchanged the truth for a lie, and he's lived with that lie so long, it's destroying him. And the problem here, and the difference between him and Juliana is that once Juliana realized what the lies were, she started to live in the truth. She didn't live still by the lies. And everybody that we see in this story that kind of finds some kind of freedom goes from living for the lies and in the lies and living for the truth. Because, I mean, we see that with Frank. We see that with Ed. We even see that with Robert, you know, at the very end, you know, choosing to help Ed and what's his name? Ed's boyfriend. I can't remember his name.
I can't either.
Yeah, I don't know why. But you see all of these characters who, and that's the thing that, and I think that's the difference is that of the people that then go and help Juliana in the end, how you survive. Are you going to continue to, even when you're faced, confronted with the truth, which is the film, right? How you choose to live after that lets you know what side you are truly on. And in the end, that we can't live a life that embraces lies as if they're the truth, because they'll end up destroying us. And that's, I think, when we think about like survival in this series, I think that's the thing that I was really struck by and we're seeing. And I think that it plays so well. You mentioned really early on in the episode, but I think one of the most important things was this whole idea of this year null, where the Führer's great plan to basically collectively brainwash the American Reich is to take away their history from them. I love Nicole's quote. She says, "Deprive people of their national consciousness, dilute their national pride, do not teach their history." The way that you destroy a people is, and to control them, is to take away everything that makes them who they are, which that's our history, our tradition, our sense of being, who we are. All of that comes from the past. And when you destroy somebody's past, you can mold their future however they want. And that's exactly what the Führer wants, basically. He wants to mold the Nazi youth, the American Reich, to make them in their image by not allowing them to have any other image but the Reich. And I think it blew my mind. And this is the thing I think I love the most about this season, was this whole idea, because it's the one that's I see playing out in our world today, honestly. And it's the one that's most scary to me. And I loved that it's juxtaposed against Frank and the Jews. And you have that beautiful ceremony of his bar mitzvah where, you know, he's reminded that the way our people have survived for 5,000 years is by our tradition, by knowing who we are, that it's not about a place, it's not about anything else, it's about intrinsically knowing who we are. And that is what allows and keeps us from being able to be to be able to survive in a way that many other places have not been able to survive. And I just thought there's a real beauty to this whole idea, but also a real it's scary to watch, because you know, the moment that we forget the past, we're just doomed to repeat it. And this season really makes that clear, in the way that if you want to destroy a society, you begin to completely deprive people of any kind of national consciousness, national pride, history, good and bad. Like, we need the good history and the bad history, because if we forget our bad history, we're doomed to repeat it. And so there's an importance of having both. And it's just a really, I think it's the best, for me, this is the best part of this season.
Yeah, I completely agree. My favorite, the high moment of the season for me was that episode, and the cross-cutting I thought was brilliant between, you know, Himmler making his speech and Frank's bar mitzvah. And I mean, that it was artistically beautiful, narratively beautiful, and it made the point that the writers and producers were trying to make very powerfully and very obviously, but in a good way, not obvious in a kind of, you know, like hitting you on the head with it. It was very clear and undeniable, but in a way that was tactful and tasteful. And I felt like, you know, it's like you said, it's these two very powerful, simple but very strong ideas. On the one hand, you know, you can do what you need to do to live, to survive, but you won't necessarily be alive. And then on the other end, there is the concept of you can't kill an idea. And the fact that, you know, the people, the characters who embrace, who understand that notion, that my life, I mean, to go back to a comparison with Star Wars, that plays out in that moment between Obi-Wan Kenobi and Darth Vader in the first film, right? When Vader basically tells Kenobi, you're old, you're weak, you can't win. And in essence, Kenobi tells him, I've already won. Because basically, either I win the fight or you strike me down and I still win the fight. Because he understands that it's not his winning, his survival is not hanging on to his own flesh and body, is not hanging on to, you know, it's just living true to the idea that he believes in all the way to the end. And that if he has faith in that, then he, you know, he cannot be beaten. He cannot be defeated because the idea cannot be killed. Even if his body is, he has faith that in death, that will help, that will do what must be done for the idea to live on, which brings about the villain's defeat. And it's the same thing here, you know, you can see kind of, you can, and it's very well played, you know, by the actor, I forget his name, who plays Himmler, this kind of consuming madness, this greed of this like power that feeds him as the plan comes together, as he makes his speech. But you can see how that is, that's the same as Vader saying, you know, I've won, you're weak. You can see that in the, what it gives is it does not provide anything beyond that moment. And that's what's the same thing George talked about in Good versus Evil, you know, whatever gratification you get from bad, evil actions, that gratification is always only in the moment. It doesn't give you anything really in the long term, which is why it's not self-sustaining. It's not real fuel. And so you keep having to refill yourself with it more and more and more and more often, because it doesn't feed you, it doesn't give you anything, until the point where you just cannot no longer feed yourself that, and then you just crumble. Whereas you see Frank and you see him understanding through that ritual that his life in the most beautiful way is irrelevant, and that he's safe in the best way, no matter what happens to him, because he's part of this thing which is so much bigger than him, so much older than him, and which through that he understands will carry on through him and beyond him, which I think is why it leads his spoiler alert, his death scene in the season is beautiful, and that I thought was very well done, because it's easy to overplay and to kind of go cliche when a character has this sort of moment where they, you know, they're going to die. They know they're going to die, and they embrace that. A lot of times, you can play that kind of too on the corny side. But I thought it was done beautifully by both actors, because you can see that there's this form of respect. They both understood, right, that the faith in what they are is something which allows them to really not fear death, because their lives are about something much bigger than their own flesh and body. And so I think that's ultimately his reward, sort of, is that he is killed, but he is completely at peace and unafraid, because he knows that he's embraced this thing that's so much bigger than him.
Yeah, I think, you know, one of the things that I thought was really interesting is that there is really a clear distinction between these two types of societies, right? You know, when like you were talking about the, you know, the inner cutting between Himmler and the Bar Mitzvah, and there is a clear distinction of one is better than the other, you know, that not all societies are equal, you know, and therefore we can make that distinction between societies that are better for. Again, it becomes, there is that utilitarian type of argument, but I think it even goes way beyond that. It's just, when we see the two side by side, we can clearly say one is better than the other, you know, and we know that instinctively. And I think that's the thing that, you know, makes that beautiful, is because there is the distinction as well between one that is rooted in thousands of years of history that have allowed people to survive, and one that is trying to force everybody to live in just one specific, very narrow human view of what is, you know, quote unquote perfect, you know, and I think that's the difference between a human ideal of what is perfect and looking towards something, like you said, beyond yourself religiously, you know. I mean, I think all religions look towards something beyond themselves for something bigger. And so I think there is a big difference there. And I just really appreciated that the season was willing to get into that kind of big question that, you know, these are the meta questions of life that the show is talking about throughout its three seasons. And I think this season brings it to a head, you know, with that moment. And it's a great place to go, I think, with this season. We talked a lot about Julia on earlier, but I thought it was interesting that I feel like next to John Smith, she is still very much a thread, because in many ways it's her choices that are moving things forward, and she's continually kind of inspiring people still. And a lot of the people that we see make the choices that they do are because of her. You know, like Frank and Ed, Wyatt, even Togomi. And I think there's even some residual effect on John Smith and his relationship with Juliana, and the plans that she put into place, you know, like I don't know if he even realizes it, but, you know, the reason that he had the film was partly in place because of her and Togomi. You know, like, and so what I thought was really interesting is that there is still this nucleus of this person who is, her actions are having all of these ripple effects, and she isn't quite as, I don't know if she's quite as much the centerpiece this season as she was last season, maybe, but that there, she's still very much the center stone that's rippling the pond. And these ripples just continue to flow outwards from the choices that she's making. I thought that was really cool to see that they're still continuing that. And that makes me interested to see specifically where, you know, she ends up in season four. And I think then, of course, on the other side, the other thread with where, you know, John Smith ends up.
Yeah, I agree. I think that she is definitely meant to still be the thrust that you described, and kind of that, you know, you put it perfectly, this sort of ripple effect that affects all the other characters and is going to kind of affect the destiny of this world in the end, probably. I could tell that this was definitely the intention. To me, it felt like there were other things coming into the season that, even though it was the intention, somewhat diluted that. And so that's why, on a personal level, at the end of the day, at the end of the season, I was more interested, or I felt like the character of Smith was a clearer through line, or sort of had seemed stronger as a central through line into the season than she was. And that, I think, has to do with what I touched upon a little earlier, which I think that generally speaking, it felt, and if I'm going to critique the show this season, it's really going to be on that I'm going to ding it. And again, I love the season overall. So we're talking about, like, you know, critique within a positive area, right? But I felt like they got maybe a little too ambitious in some ways, and tried to have the story be a little too big in several ways, one of which was by introducing, I believe, too many characters. And none of them are bad characters in and of themselves. They're all interesting characters. So I could see why, as writers, especially good writers, you think of these people and you're like, oh man, it would be cool to have this character, it would be cool to have that character. But at the end of the day, you have to do service to the story. And if you have 12 characters and they're all awesome, but you realize, if you do, because, you know, 2020 hindsight is also easy, if you do at the time, that having 12 awesome characters does a disservice to the story, you owe it to the story to say, okay, well, crap, it sucks, but what ones are the ones that we really need for the story, and what are the ones that are hurting or might hurt the story? And no matter how cool they are, we gotta ask those. And I felt like they were definitely I don't know if they were aware of that going in, but I felt like they were somewhat aware at some point, at least, because their effort to kind of cull down the number of characters and kill off some of them, you know, I don't think was just for drama's sake or incidental. I think it was them being aware that they had too big of an ensemble and that they had to start to kind of narrow down the number of arcs we're going to follow. And so they were, you know, I've seen that in other shows before where at some point you can see the writers becoming aware, it's branching off too much. So we have to like tie off this loose end and this loose end so that we can kind of, bring it back to the main trunk of the tree. And I feel like that definitely touched on Juliana, but all the others, I felt, for example, I thought I liked the concept of pairing up every character, because if you look at the season, they literally paired up every character. Everyone had a love arc to a degree. And I mean that in the best way, you know, not as a soap opera kind of thing, but like where to explore the dimension of the character. And again, if you just look at that character and what that did, it's very interesting. It's very well done. But combined, I think it did a disservice to the story, because some of them, if you were doing like, you know, I don't know, some kind of ancillary material related to Man in the High Castle, I would say, oh, I would love to watch webisodes about, you know, this character and see kind of that they had this relationship, you know, like the Kempe, you know, and so on. That's really interesting. But I felt like it kind of got in the way of the bigger pillars of this story and the world of this story. And in a way, it kind of like, if you're going to explore concepts of love and you know, good and wrong, how people can still be good and how they have a relationship with someone, even people who are in a position to do bad things. All these are interesting concepts, but when you do it for every character, it starts to kind of appear a little formulaic. And then at the end of the day, what that happens is it kind of decreases the quality of it for all the characters, as opposed to like, if you do it for the best of the characters who really advance the story, then I think it really comes, it strengthens the master story and also that concept. So I feel like that kind of is what made, just speaking of Juliana, kind of, you know, it's what didn't make her as strong in the season as someone like Smith for me, for example.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. I think there's a lot of places in the season where, you know, we just have lots of story, you know, and there are many places where I think, where you mentioned, you know, we're kind of culling characters because we need the story to be more focused than in season 4 going forward. You know, Frank meets his end, Joe meets his end. You know, we have John possibly losing his family, so maybe we don't have to focus on that quite as much the next season. You know, it might come intermittently. It might come every once in a while, but you know, you're not going to get it a lot, possibly. Himmler's on death's door. You know, heck, Lady Liberty died, and so did the Bell. we have a lot of things that have gone by the wayside in this season. And I'm very interested to see the way that we move forward with there. But there were parts of the story that I was appreciative that they did add. Like, I loved that, you know, in the second season we had Tagomi face the fact of having a family in the other world, and it almost seems as that impacts him, so that once he meets the woman on the beach and they start this relationship, that he begins to basically live life again. Like, he finally opens up to the fact that there is more to life than just doing his job. Whereas, you know, I felt like with the inspector kind of adding that kind of weird relationship he has with the girl at the bar is a little bit strange to me. Like, but then him setting her, you know, free, and, you know, that she has the money to go then live wherever that she wants was interesting. But, you know, like, so just kind of juxtaposing, there were parts where I felt like you were really adding to a character in their story. And then there were other parts where it's like, I don't mind this story, but I'm not quite sure if this is exactly the place I want us to be spending as much time as we're kind of devoting it to it in certain episodes, you know? So, you know, I do agree. I think there were places where I almost wish that they had found a way to tighten the season up a little bit with the character lines and the character stories that they had going.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And those were great examples. I think that they're both really cool. They're both really cool character explorations because they both help make these characters more real. So in and of themselves, in a vacuum, they're very well thought out. But like you were saying, I feel like Togomi's arc really not only is very well thought out on an individual level, but really serves a greater purpose in advancing the overall story of the world and the sort of the overall arc of the series. Whereas the Inspector's is cool, but it doesn't feel as necessary to the overarching story of the series. And it's one of those, you know, where if Man in the High Castle did like shorts like Star Trek Discovery did, you know, I would say, okay, it's great. If you want to give me like 2 or 3 10-minute episodes that show, you know, the fact that the Inspector has this kind of what his personal life is, or the comparison of like the struggle, the inner struggle he has between the fact that he has his family and he misses them in Japan. He wishes he had never come to the United States because, you know, he's a far apart from his homeland and his family, but he's kind of grown almost his own secondary life. And that kind of comes with its own moral decisions. I would say that's a great thing to do, but it doesn't feel like it comes in the way as far as part of the main through line for the series. And I felt like that they did a little too much of that overall. And in it, even like in terms of locations, the bar that we keep going to in Denver, it's a beautiful set. Like, it's a gorgeous set. And you can tell that they spent a lot of time building this great set, lighting it beautifully. It's a great setup for some cool scenes, but then it feels to me like it becomes this extra place which they now have, and now someone says, well, we got to use it. And I feel like it's one place too many to go to, which doesn't really, in a way, on the one hand, I feel like at the meta level, it's not really a necessary place to advance the plot, but because they have it, it kind of creates almost in a clumsy way the exact opposite, where now because they want to use it, it becomes this deus ex machina place where if you look at it, even though it's supposed to be this kind of random dive bar in Denver, every central character to the story at some point in the season winds up at that bar for one reason or another. Which kind of then sort of spills for me almost into like a small universe syndrome, where randomly, coincidentally, these people who don't really come in contact with one another and who are like at complete, I mean, we have like, you know, the Reichsführer almost, and then these people on the Pacific States, and, you know, these gangsters, everybody goes through this place. It feels like it's a little contrived. And it kind of drives the story in places that I almost don't want it to go. And again, I sound more critical than I really am, because it was never bad, but I felt like it was kind of not as natural as the story could have been if it hadn't had all these extra things that they tried to build up. Like, I feel like they were almost on the verge of falling into the trappings of other series like The X-Files or Lost, which sort of become trapped by their own success and feel like, well, shoot, what are we going to do? Because people love this so much, we have to go bigger next season. We have to have more sets, more characters, more plot lines. And that usually goes only one place, which is at some point you have too many plays to juggle and it kind of all falls apart. So I hope that they're wise enough to kind of do what Battlestar Galactica, for example, did. They also started, in my opinion, the new series to kind of go there. And I think caught themselves and then brought it back and wrapped things up right before it got really too crazy. And I think, I hope that, that Man in the High Castle can do the same thing of sort of keeping their eye on the goal line, not trying to necessarily just go bigger from season to season, and then just say, let's just stick to the story we're trying to tell and do what we need to do to tell that story. Nothing more.
Yeah. One of the things that I did like is, you know, when we get to the, you know, that very last episode and we have one of the things that we get the culmination of, you know, all the time we've spent with Wyatt, which I thought was really good. And the fact that he basically takes up the mantle once Juliana is gone and finds a way that he can influence things with his friend who's in the pornography business, which is, again, a place that shows us the way in which people in the Reich are willing to break the rules for their, you know, whatever their desires are. But using that to his advantage to create copies of the film, you know, to spread out across the world. But at the same time, you know, also working to shoot Himmler, possibly taking him out of the picture. And then, you know, the ways in which, you know, of course, then we have that where, you know, Juliana finally travels to another world. And so, you know, I feel like between her and Smith and Wyatt and where their three storylines go, I'm really fascinated to see where they take this for a fourth season. And I also hope that, and this is just my hope, is just that season four is also the last season. I'm hoping that they will not try and do the thing where, oh yes, we've been popular, so we just need to keep continuing the storyline. I don't want the storyline to get diluted. I really want things to find a way to come to a close. And I feel like it feels like to me that what you've done in season three has given you a good opportunity then to wrap the series up with a season four. Specifically, since we now know there's no way for the Nazis to actually enact their plan anyway of traveling to other worlds the way that they want to. So that's really kind of, I think, you know, a moot point. So this isn't about traveling to other universes and necessarily trying to completely protect them, because they can never do what they want to do anyway. This really is about finding a way to enact change in this world.
I completely agree with you. And I think you talked about like the whole Nazi plot of, you know, invading other worlds. And I'm as a sort of like even almost old school classic sci-fi high concept, it's really cool. I really hope that, going with what I was saying and what you just said, that it the only extent to which it's part of season four is as a device to help explore the internal conflicts that we talked about. Because, you know, I mean, if you listen back to what we've been saying for the last hour, to me, and if we just, not to be presumptuous, but if we use ourselves, right, kind of as an example, as a sort of a sample of what is relevant and deep and good about this show, you can tell that it's really, you know, the questions it asks about us, about our nature, internal things, which is what, in my opinion, all good, quote unquote, you know, pure sci-fi with a capital P does, is really actually ask questions about human nature. And I think that, you know, the whole invasion plot is really silly if we're going to go just with the sci-fi aspect of it, almost in a kind of Flash Gordon way. If they're using it as a plot device to heighten the stakes and the questions, the internal questions, and the moral compasses of the characters in the series, then it's a great potential plot device. But like you said, the idea, if we're going to go into kind of like the Star Trek tech dynamics of that idea, is so silly, so ridiculous, that it would, you know, I really hope that they're not trying to kind of make the show bigger and more epic by saying, oh, and now we're going to have this kind of ticking clock of like this potential Nazi invasion across universes. Because it's really based on the rules that they've set up themselves for how this works and what happens. It's just completely silly. It just would not work at all. So, you know, I really, for me, like what I'm really excited about season four is what we talked about, the continuation of these explorations, these internal explorations. And then that brings me back, you know, one last time to kind of that, to me, that really symbolizes it, that cross-cutting sequence between Himmler announcing Year Null and then Frank's Bar Mitzvah. And I really think that is where the true depth and the soul of this show rests. You know, it has the ability to do that and to use science fiction ideas to really express very well these beautiful, powerful notions. You know, I think that even in the filmmaking, something I wanted to touch on quickly, the filmmaking aspect, and you talked when we were discussing that those sequences about the idea that, you know, some choices are clearly good and some choices are bad, and evoking that innate sense of knowing what is good and what is wrong. And I think that the filmmaking in those moments is really strong and is crafted intentionally to do that. You have, you know, Frank's Bar Mitzvah is all shot inside, and it creates this inner, you know, comfortable womb-like feeling. The light is warm. The lighting is meant to be, you know, all with warm colors, safe and inviting. The sequence with Himmler and Year Null is the exact opposite. It's all outside. It's all shot and lit with really cool colors. It's cold. It's wider lenses that show, you know, much more imposing sense of scale, but not in a good way. It's kind of all very massive and weighty instead of being sort of, you know, closed lenses that sort of create this kind of intimate feeling of safety and comfort. And so that's really, I think, in the music is beautiful and used in editing very well in that sequence. And I think that this is really where the show is at its best, when it like uses the sci-fi high concept premise of the series and the filmmaking skills of everyone involved to kind of really bring it all towards these really powerful universal internal questions about our nature.
What, kind of thinking along those lines then, if you were going to kind of give a rating to season three, where do you think you fall?
That's a good question. I think I would probably give it on a scale of, let's say, five. I'd give it a 3.75, 3.75. I think I would probably give season two a 4 or 4.25, you know, on a scale of 1 to 5. So it's very strong. It's very good. It's very entertaining. It's very well shot. It's very well acted. Overall, it's well written. It's not quite as effective in my mind as season two was. Not quite as pure in the narrative. That's why I kind of ding it a little bit. But it's still really, really good.
I kind of loved that that moment, and I didn't mention it earlier, but, you know, with Year Null being announced, and it was a perfect representation of Padme in episode 3. So this is how Liberty dies, to thunderous applause. And it's exactly the same type of moment. And I loved getting to kind of see that played out in a different place and legitimately almost the same type of way.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. And I don't know if you remember when I was watching season two, I remember exactly where I was even. It was like winter, like whatever, a year or 2 years ago. And I was, you know, I was watching the episode where it's when they're in Berlin, and where there's this huge speech in front of the assembly. And I remember texting you, and I was like, 'cause I had this moment where I was really just thinking to myself, oh my God, if George was making the prequels today and was making it for streaming, because let's face it, this is kind of where content is at, like quality content today, this is kind of what it would be like. You know, this is what, this is the scope and the epicness of the prequel story would be. It would play out like that. And I remember texting him being like, man, I can't wait for you to watch this, because it really kind of evokes in the best way possible all the things that I think George was trying to talk about politically, with the ways that people can be manipulated and, you know, good becoming evil, et cetera, et cetera. And our perception of what is heroic and what isn't. I completely agree. Yeah. It feels very much to me. And it's funny because, you know, George is inspired by what was the politics of his time and of his childhood and kind of the teachings of, you know, what happened in World War II and how Hitler took power. And so it's kind of like this full circle idea where you see in this thing, which is an alternative world, that is followed the consequences of different outcomes in World War II, you see a lot of these same ideas play out that I think George sort of disseminated in his Star Wars.
Yeah, I think I remember rating season 2 might have been 4.5 for me. I think this season is probably a 4 for me. It like you said, it doesn't reach the heights of season 2 because I don't think it's quite as tight in the storytelling. But I think a lot of the themes that we got a chance to talk about, I just really enjoyed and liked about it. And so therefore, you know, I am overlooking some of the things that I see as being not quite as strong and giving it a higher rating just because I think they did those things well. And so, you know, it is a show where I am very interested to see where it goes. But I'm also, you know, as we mentioned, I'm also in the place where I do want this show to not outlive its usefulness, like Kirk and Spock in Star Trek VI. just a little joke there.
Well done.
Yeah, and to find a way to tell a complete story that can deal, because the problem is that if you do let this go on too long, you will dilute what they've been trying to do, I think, thematically. And so keeping it less seasons will actually keep that stronger. So I'm very excited to see what, you know, what will happen in season 4 and what they do there. So be looking forward to getting a chance to talk about it with you then. It's been a blast getting a chance to talk through all these kind of things. I love when, you know, entertainment can make us truly think and reflect on where we are and who we are and what we want to be. And I think that this is a show that truly does that. And so I want to thank you to send out a huge thanks to our associate producers, Ken Tripp, Davis Grayson, Daniel Noah, and Ryan Millett for their support of the network here on Patreon. Patreon.com is the best place to go to help support the network. We are a huge network, and there's no way that we can afford, just as hosts, to put this network together every single week without people just like you. Patreon.com allows you to support the network a little bit each month. We also have great contribution levels that you can subscribe at that allow certain perks, like, as I mentioned, our associate producers here all chose the 602 Club as one of their perks to be associate producer of. There are other perks that come as well. But again, honestly, every little bit helps. So go to patreon.com/trekfm and see how you can be part of the team. Now, I love having you on, Nick. It is so much fun getting a chance to talk about you know, things like this together. And it's always fun to be back together since this is actually how we met. So let everybody know where they can find you if they want to catch up with you and talk to you more about maybe this or anything else that you've got going on, since you've got a pretty busy life these days.
Yes, I do. It's always, I mean, to say it's a pleasure is an understatement. Like you said, this is where we met. This is the first place where I kind of started to get into podcasts, listening, and then, you know, being lucky enough to participate. You know, you and John, a whole, you know, other group of people that, that I'm really proud to come call friends now. It is a privilege for me when we find the time to have these discussions again. If people want to reach me, the best, I don't have a very big footprint on the interwebs. The best is to get to me on the Book of Faces. They can find me under my name there. Also, I am quite active in the Babel Conference, Trek FM's forum on Facebook. I'm there every week. Even if I pipe in only a couple of times, I'll make a point to just be there and say hey to my favorite host and friends there. So those are probably the two best places to find me.
Awesome. And it is always great when you pop in there, because usually it's a, I would say, quite lengthy discussion point about something that you've been thinking about, which is always really fun to get to read. So make sure you do look up Nick there on the Book of Faces. You can find me all over the place on social media under the name MattRushing02. I'm on Twitter, Instagram, Letterboxd, and Tumblr under that name. You can also find me here on the network doing The Orb with Chris Jones, talking about Star Trek Deep Space Nine. You can find me over on the Nerd Party Network doing two shows. One is called Owl Post, and I do that with Drea Kaufman as we talk about Harry Potter each and every week, just one chapter at a time. It's been a lot of fun doing that, so I hope you'll check that out. And then you can also find me doing the show Aggressive Negotiations with John Mills. And each week we just choose a topic from Star Wars that we've been thinking about, kind of dive in deep with that. It is a lot of fun. I think you'll love it. And then last but not least, I do a show called Cinema Stories with my good friend Courtney. And that's where we talk about films, but through the lens of faith. But thank you so much for joining us. And y'all come back now, you hear? Mm-hmm.